So you're sitting in your office toward the end of the day. You're following along with your favorite team on MLB.com, watching a graphical representation of every pitch and getting play-by-play updates on a scrolling feed. When work is done, you take to the streets. You pull out your smartphone and continuously check the score all the way to the train station. Then you put in your headphones and tune in to the audio broadcast. When you reach your stop, you walk to the park and ride lot, get in your car, start it, and find the game on the radio. When you get home, you can watch the last few innings on TV. I'm sorry, that ended up sounding a whole lot more like a commercial than I wanted it to, but it's not, I promise. It's the truth. Between our computers, our smartphones, and good old-fashioned radio and TV, we have more ways than ever to watch our favorite teams, or really, any team we want. But who's behind all these different channels? Who are the ones who work hard to get us all this information? From the Curt Flood Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. I'm talking to the presenters today from all different walks of life. You know those game feeds you can follow on your computer and smartphone? My first guest, Larry Menken, is responsible for a lot of those. I'll talk to him about the ins and outs of that job. Then I'll talk to Clay Wendler, someone behind our favorite way to show clips online, the GIF. And Brewers announcer Joe Block talks about his trial by fire as a young play-by-play man.
So I was literally working games next to a blind person. And what better reminder could a young play-by-play announcer need than the guy next to you can't see, just like the rest of the audience can't see.
All that plus the MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. I was at a convention for the Society for American Baseball Research. The day's presentations were over, and we were all just kind of sitting around the hotel lobby, shaking hands and sharing stories. And I met Larry Menken. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and we started talking about our lives and our jobs and things like that. And then Larry said something very interesting. He said, at night, as a side job, he was a game stringer for MLB.com. Or more accurately, a game day datacaster. So I asked him, what does a game day datacaster do? And he said that he got to show up to a ballpark, sit in the press box, and record every event on the field so that it could be streamed over the internet to our computers and smartphones. And I thought, no way, that's a real job. But it is, and he has it. And he was nice enough to come on and tell us a little bit more about his very interesting job. Larry, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I guess we'll start first things first. How does one become a game day datacaster for Major League Baseball?
Well, I guess you kind of have to get lucky. But the way that I got the job was that I happened to know a guy who already had the job and had to move. So he had the connections. But normally what they do is in the off season, most of the markets have some kind of opening and they send out a posting on monster.com saying that we're looking for stat stringers on at these MLB markets. And you send in a resume and they pick out people who have the experience they're looking for. Generally, they're looking for people who have experience working with professional sports. It does help to have connections, but, you know, all I had was one. That connection was Joe Dimino, who used to cover the Orioles and Nationals, which is my current job. And he had to move to the Midwest, It was the middle of the season, so they needed someone to fill in at the last minute. So he put me in touch with the boss.
I'm hoping you can kind of take us through a sort of day in the life. I know that this isn't your full-time job. It's more of a, well, literally a night gig, pretty much as far as baseball games go. But can you kind of take us through what the average work day is for a datacaster? Like, what time do you show up to the ballpark and all that kind of stuff?
Well, we're required to show up at the ballpark at least an hour before first pitch, usually earlier than that. Just to make sure that we have time to make any changes to the file that needs to be made. When the home team press media relations gives out the game notes and the lineups, then we go into the program that MLB.com uses, and we check to make sure that the roster is current and accurate for any changes that need to be made. We get in touch with our support person over an instant messaging program. And once those changes are made, we input the lineup, we connect to the server, and then we wait for the first pitch. And when the game starts, we obviously, when we put in the pitch locations and the results of all the pitches, and we put in all the official data that comes in. When the official scorer announces what the time of the first pitch is, we put that in. The official score announces what the official temperature is, we put that in. And when a pitch comes in, the result of the pitch is either a ball or a strike or a ball put in play. And we put in what type of ball it was, what type of strike it was, type of swing strike, a called strike. And if it's a ball, if there's runners on base and the ball's in the blocked in the dirt, then we indicate that. And then if the ball's put in play, there's three options there. It can be either a ball put in play and out recorded, a ball put in play, no out recorded, or a ball put in play, run scored. Obviously, the ball put in play, run scored trumps everything else. And we put that in as soon as it's determined what it is going to be. So once the run scores, we put in ball and play, run scored. If there's no run scored but there's an out recorded, we put in ball and play, out recorded. And then when the play is over, we put in a code indicating what happened on the play, where the ball was hit, who fielded the ball, what type of trajectory there was for the ball, where the base runners went. And sometimes you have to wait for the official score to make a decision, obviously, on a base hit or an error. So there can be a bit of delay. So sometimes you're watching the game on game day and you see, well, what's taking so long? You might be just waiting for the official score to decide if it was a hit or an error.
And I've looked through that game day information, especially on the balls in play, or even, you know, the outs, basically anything that's not a strikeout, you know, or a walk. There's a lot of code that goes into signifying just what happens, because it's basically just a string of numbers and characters, not unlike, I don't know, you obviously have experience with the retro sheet logs, basically the historical data that's kept online that you can look through, and they have, you know, under the game sequence, they have, you know, exactly what happened, which runners moved, you know, where the ball was hit and stuff like that. Is that something that you knew going in? Did that help you get a leg up in when you became a data caster?
I like to think that it did help me get the job, that I was familiar with the retro sheet scoring system, because the system the MLB uses is not dissimilar from it. They have made changes to it that will work better with the software to get in all the information that we need. I had previously, for my own just interest in stats, I had taught myself how to read that Project Score Sheet system that Bill James invented, which RetroSheet uses, so that I could get information from statistics, whatever type of situational statistic I was looking for. You needed to be able to parse that language. So I taught myself the basics of it. And so when I did get into this job, I did have a bit of a leg up. It didn't take me quite as long, I think, to learn it. But there's still, you know, I've been doing this since 2007, and I don't think I was completely comfortable with the scoring system until this past season, because there's some codes that very rarely come up. So they're not at the forefront of your memory, and you have to kind of ask for help from your support person sometimes, like, man, what was the code on that play? We actually have a cheat sheet that we carry with us in the press box that has some common codes in case you're not entirely sure what it is. you know, the worst thing you could possibly do is put the wrong code in. You know, it's better to wait a couple seconds and get a confirmation from your support guy than to put the wrong code in and have to go and fix it.
But for the most part, you're pretty much a pro at this now, right? I mean, you kind of think in code now when you see a ball put in play on the field?
Yeah, whenever I see a ball hit to the second baseman and to throw out to the first, I think 4-3/G. And if it's a soft one, I put a minus sign at the end of it.
Do you still score games the old-fashioned way with a scorecard and a pencil, or is that part of your brain broken now?
Well, I do score them with a card and a pencil, but I've kind of forgotten the old way of scoring because there's so much less information. I mean, the old way of scoring doesn't even indicate the pitch sequence. So I print off the project score sheet scorecards, and I bring them to the ballpark with me, and I score them that way, which also helps keep in practice. You know, we actually, during the off season, are given practice games to make sure that our coding is up to snuff because, you know, you don't watch baseball for a couple months and you kind of get out of it a little bit. So they make sure that we're not like completely backsliding.
And now this is, like I said, a part-time job for you, but you obviously had to have a love for baseball to even get into it. When you're not watching a game, you know, as a fan, but when you're actually working a game, do you still get... Do you still get the same kind of enjoyment out of it, or is there a different kind of enjoyment, or do you approach it pretty much just like a job, show up, do what you have to do it right, and then you can leave kind of thing?
You know, if you really love baseball, it's impossible to do this job and not enjoy it. You know, I was very fortunate in 2012 to be able to cover the Orioles' first playoff game since 1997. And, you know, if you sat in that press box and I don't care if it's one of those grizzled reporters who's been there for 30 years, you know, just the emotion of that place, all the fans getting all so hyped up, you do feel excited. And when you see a great play, yeah, you got to put the code in, but you know, there's all the time I'm communicating with my support staff of what a great play it was, what an amazing long home run was, you know, how exciting a game is. You know, the downside of the job is that sometimes there's games that aren't tremendously exciting and you got to stay there for the whole thing and you can't miss anything, which is the downside is, you know, when you're a fan and a game gets to be out of hand, you can turn it off and do something else. And I got to stay there for the whole thing. Fortunately, that doesn't happen as much as it used to.
Well, it seems like such an interesting job. And, you know, I wish you the best of luck. Keep on doing what you're doing because you're responsible for a lot of people finding out the very most up-to-date information on their favorite teams. Larry Mankin is a game day datacaster for MLB.com. Larry, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, David.
Coming up, I will talk to Brewers radio announcer Joe Block, and love him or hate him, it seems like we can't live without him. It's the almighty GIF. That plus the MVP of my heart. Stay tuned. All right, I'm going to get this out of the way before we get started. .gif, the file extension, to me, is still pronounced GIF. That's the way I learned it when I took computer classes in college, and that's the way I'm going to continue to say it, probably until we don't care about them anymore. GIFs, of course, are all over the internet now, usually involving silly things like cats playing the piano or something like that. But in the world of baseball, they're also used for in-depth analysis, whether it's an article about pitch framing by catchers on Baseball Prospectus or something by, let's say, yours truly on Fangraphs about the slowest pitches to allow home runs. GIFs are a quick and easy way to get video representation on your computer screen. And one of the biggest producers of GIFs, especially sports-related GIFs on the internet today, is Clay Wendler. He's a multimedia producer for SBNation.com. Clay, thanks for being here.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
Now, you're a multimedia producer for SB Nation, which is a fancy title. But if you boil it down, a lot of what you do is making GIFs for the site. Can you tell us a little bit about GIFs and how you use them in SB Nation?
Yeah, I think we basically use GIFs as just another way to tell a story or I think the best part about the format is that they're just, I mean, they're so shareable and so easy to, you know, to tweet out a link or a twit pic of a GIF, and it's just so easy to share, you know, something funny or a big highlight, or we've also kind of started using them as analysis tools for, you know, breaking down plays and stuff like that. But I think really the kind of the chief use to me is using them as a vehicle to share things that happen as fast as possible on the internet.
And they're pretty convenient too, right? Because you don't have to, especially from maybe like a back end infrastructure standpoint, they don't take up a whole lot of space. And as opposed to something like a YouTube video or, you know, a video embedded on some other player, there's no extra software that somebody has to download or anything like that. It just plays right in their browser.
Right. Yeah. It's much easier. And, you know, actually when I started doing this, we actually started doing it with video. And then a few months later, we switched almost entirely to sharing GIFs. So yeah, it's just so easy to share.
Now I'm hoping you can walk us through your process a little bit. I know that while we're talking, you're going to work a basketball game in a little bit, but you also do all sorts of sports. So can you, divulging any company secrets, of course, can you kind of walk us through, you know, how your setup looks, how you get all that video into your computer, and how you turn that around into a GIF the way you do?
Right. Well, I mean, I basically have a setup where I have several satellite boxes running as much as possible, and those are all networked, so I can just. They share all their content, so I only have to connect my computer to one of them, and I have access to everything that's recorded, and I just use a video capture card that goes right into the satellite receiver, and that pretty much spits out whatever kind of video file I need, and I can just sit there, and I'm watching the game or I'm usually recording several things at once, but I can just sit there, and if something happens, I could just back it up, or maybe I'll just be recording constantly, and I can just stop the recording and just dump the video file to my computer, and then I can go ahead and I can resize that or crop it or speed it up or slow it down, just try to turn it into a GIF as fast as possible. So people on the internet can enjoy it.
And that must be, I mean, that sounds terribly stressful.
Simple.
I guess. Yeah,
stressful?
No, I would say stressful, yeah, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like you're always just constantly just looking for stuff to turn around, and it's just, you're being, bombarded by it, like, all right. Evening long.
Well, it can be stressful. I mean, I've never really thought of watching sports as being all that stressful, but the way we work, we have a lot of different people watching a lot of different things all at once. So, you know, the load is not placed entirely on me. So, you know, I'm looking for things, other people are looking for things, and they see something, they'll tell me about it, and I can go grab it. So it's not as stressful as you might think, but when things really get hot, like on an NFL Sunday when there's, you know, seven or eight games going at once, sometimes that can be a little hectic.
And I want to circle back to something you said earlier, because it's something I think that's really interesting. The fact that we can use these files, these little video files, as a source of entertainment, like you said, they're easily shareable. You can email them or tweet them or put them on your Facebook page or something like that. If somebody makes a funny face or someone falls down or, sort of blooper type stuff. But it's also used if you go to, other pages on SB Nation, like Beyond the Box Score or something on Baseball Prospectus or Fangraphs, people are using these files as analysis tools. Now, is that something that you... Is that something that you get requests for to make those kind of files? Because I'm guessing it's pretty specific when you're looking at pitch deliveries and swing planes and things.
Yeah, like a lot of the team sites that fall under our SB Nation United brand, like our, for instance, our Steelers site, behindthesteelcurtain.com, every week they'll send me a request for several plays from the Steelers game, and there'll usually be like a set of instructions with how they want to like highlight a particular block or something that somebody did on the play that was like key to the play happening. And, you know, I'll put, you know, graphics on it and captions and stuff like that. But, that's something that several of the, more than several, probably dozens of our blogs have been doing, like even independently of me. And then there are several blogs that come to me, looking for our particular plays that they want to highlight every week for some kind of breakdown or review.
And I have to, now, you sound like a pretty young guy, but I imagine that when you got out of school, whatever level of school that was, doesn't even matter. I can't imagine anybody comes out of school and says, you know what I want to do? I want to record little computer videos for a website. Like, how does one get that job, I guess? Do you have experience with video editing from previous jobs, or how did you come about this?
No, it's actually a really funny story. I went to school for journalism, and as soon as I got out of school, I was working for a magazine. I was doing writing and editing and managing a team of writers and running a website, and I wasn't really doing anything with video right when I got out of school. But I'd always kind of had an interest in film and video, and I'd always had kind of a creative side to me, and probably somewhere around 2004, 2005, I just kind of started teaching myself how to use video tools on the computer, and eventually that kind of gravitated toward GIFs and you know, working with Adobe Premiere and Adobe Photoshop and stuff like that, and really just kind of started as a hobby. And I kind of got to be known in the Chiefs online community for doing a lot of stuff with video and GIFs. And I knew a guy who worked for SB Nation, and he said, you know, I think we can use some of your talents, and it just kind of sprouted from there.
Now, a lot of times when you have to make small talk with a person you just met, besides the weather, the next logical step in conversation is to go to what you do for a job. How many times have you been told that you have the coolest job anybody's heard of?
You know, I don't think.
Do you think it's cool? Do you think you have a cool job?
I think it's the coolest job in the world. I mean, I really can't think of a better way to make a living than, you know, watching sports and playing around with video and being silly every day. But I don't think a lot of people really kind of understand my job, because it's not really something you can kind of go to school for. I mean, you can go to school for video editing, but I would say there are a few people that I've talked to have told me that it's just kind of a neat job, but mostly when I'm telling people about it, I just tell them how cool it is, because, I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, I can't really complain.
Yeah, it sounds cool to me. Sounds like a pretty neat job. Do you see any advancements in, or do you see any extra responsibilities or burgeoning technology that you're going to have to adapt coming up in the next few years as you continue, you know, to stay on the cutting edge of putting video on the web?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it'll be interesting to see if the networks like change their broadcasting format eventually with like the advent of 4K TVs, because eventually I'm sure there's going to be a lot of higher bandwidth content going out.
Because the 4K stuff, that's like HD on steroids, basically, right? Not to use a cliche, but
I think broadcasting that's pretty far away. But
okay.
But what I'm kind of interested in is how people are going to. I mean, GIFs have been on the internet for a long time, but they've really only kind of been this like shareable revolution tool in the last few years, I think. And I think the format is kind of outdated. I mean, the compression is not very good. So I'm wondering if somebody is working on a way to make GIFs even smaller, because right now, a lot of times, the video file will be smaller than a GIF, depending on how long it is. So if somebody can come up with a way to make the compression involved in making GIF even more optimized, that could be really good. Then there's a little site called, I think it's called gfycat.com. They're doing this thing where you can upload your GIFs and it turns it into like HTML5 video files, and it really just looks just like a GIF. So I think there's probably some kind of, I'm not real like into the whole software and coding language, but I do know that I think there's some stuff coming out with HTML5 video that's going to be pretty neat here. So I think that's kind of the thing I'm most interested to see, is how people can take the GIF and make it a little more faster and a little more even simpler to use.
Well, Clay, I really enjoy the stuff you guys do over there on SB Nation, and I want to thank you for joining me on Stealing Home.
Sure, anytime.
Clay Wendler is a multimedia producer for SBNation.com. You can follow him and all the great GIFs that he makes on Twitter at SBNationGIF. It's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. Any kid who likes baseball has done this at least once growing up. Out in the backyard, alone, playing, and pretending. Bottom of the ninth, two men on, two outs, full count. They're either the pitcher or the hitter. Either way, they're also the announcer, ready to broadcast their amazing feat to their adoring audience. And then we all grow up and life gets boring, but there are still a few, a select few, that get to do that throughout their adult life. They get to show up to a ballpark every day and do this.
Here's the pitch, and there's a strike. Nothing and one to Betancourt. And if Figueroa does come in the game, you figure he'll go a ways. Again, the Brewers have Hand and Badenhop available, so to speak, but both with long outings yesterday. Here's the 0-1. Runner goes. Pitch is swung on. Lined over second and into right. A base hit. Gomez heading to third. Eddie Cedar's waving him home. Gomez to the plate. The throw. He's safe. And the Brewers win.
That voice you hear belongs to Joe Block, play-by-play announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers, and he's nice enough to be here. Joe, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Oh, David, glad to be on.
So, as a radio person, I know you've been working in radio for a long time, but every radio person I've ever talked to always had kind of a dream when they were a little kid of coming up and doing play-by-play for sports. Is that something that you dreamed of as a little kid?
Yeah, I mean, probably about 8 years old, I was really firmly entrenched with the idea that I was going to call Major League Baseball games at some point. I would practice, I grew up in Detroit, so we'd have the Tigers games on TV, and I would, kind of imitate George Kell and Al Kaline. I would even do the Arkansas accent for George Kell when he did the play-by-play to try to imitate what was going on there. But, and listening to Ernie Harwell and Paul Carey growing up, and then when I got a little bit older as a teenager in high school, I really started focusing in on it with my teachers, and I thought, you know, more seriously about it. And so I started listening to different guys out of state, and you know, I listened to Bob Uecker on WTMJ. You could get that in Michigan, and you know, some of the other broadcasters in and around the region. And so over time, it became more of you know, just from a dream to an actual career path. And thank goodness, I ended up doing what I always wanted to do.
And speaking of Bob Uecker, you now, I mean, you're making a name for yourself in the radio business, obviously, but becoming a co-host of sorts, a commentator for Brewers games, you also get to work with, I mean, you know, somebody everybody calls a living legend in Bob Uecker. Was that intimidating when you first started working there? Is it more exciting for you?
I suppose it could have been, but he's not that kind of person. So thank goodness, you know, I mean, he's a really easygoing guy, and you know, right off the bat, someone who's been as accomplished as he is, you know, it really could have been a situation where he could have made me feel uncomfortable, but it was never like that. You know, the first day we met, you know, he was talking about a minor medical procedure he had gone through that some men go through. We'll just put it like that. I being one of them as well. And so he had some funny analogies regarding that. And so I was immediately put at ease during our conversation. You know, it was nothing serious at all. And, you know, at the end of our dinner that we had that night, you know, he was welcoming me to the Brewers family. So, you know, it was one of those things where he probably doesn't want the word getting out that he's a really good guy and, you know, someone who has mentored me without having to really tell me anything, just, you know, by seeing him and by example. I've learned quite a bit and just listening to him. You know, he's made this a really fun, I mean, it's already fun to begin with, but he's made it just an astronomically fun thing to be able to call play-by-play alongside him.
Now, something whenever I talk to someone who has an interesting job or who I think has an interesting job, at least, and you certainly do, I always like to kind of get a snapshot of their day, their work day. Now, I saw a video that you were part of that involved you as a part of your game day prep involved you using a lot more a side that's a lot more technological than some might think. Could you kind of take us through how you get prepped for, you know, let's say a home game against the Diamondbacks or something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's not just you know, showing up at the park an hour before, eating the free food and then getting after it. You know, it starts for me in the morning. You know, I'll say a 7 o'clock game. Well, I'll spend an hour and a half or 2 hours just reading about baseball throughout the league, and then, you know, all the Brewers beat writers, and then to use your example, you know, I'll read the Arizona Republic and Diamondbacks.com to make sure I've got the latest on what Arizona's doing, and then I put all that information together in Microsoft OneNote, which is a program in the Office suite that kind of works with you know, tabs and that kind of thing, where I can, you know, have different notes on each team, and then different notes on every player within those teams. And then I also create a page for each day. So the Brewers game versus the Diamondbacks that particular day, there's going to be some notes that are relevant maybe that day or that week that are irrelevant at other times during the season. So I put all that together before I even, you know, take a shower and work out in the morning. So that all gets done, and then, you know, I have a little bit of time usually in the afternoon, and then get to the ballpark about 3 o'clock so I can talk with players and coaches on both sides, watch batting practice, talk with other media members, broadcasters, and find out what's going on. And then when the game is finally, you know, we go on the air and the game is finally getting going, I think I've got all the ammo I need to really fire off a good broadcast. So all that goes into it. Just to put on one 3-hour show every night.
And you mentioned all these notes that you have to take, but I imagine a lot of this is something you have to pull basically off the top of your head at a moment's notice. Are you blessed with a good memory, or is this something you've had to train yourself to do as an announcer?
Well, I think it's like anything, David. You know, like if you're in a class and you've got to study for a test, you know, if you look over the material enough, you're going to just kind of have it. So I think for me, I mean, I'm just like anybody, I'm just a natural baseball fan. So I retain quite a bit of knowledge, you know, about the game because I'm always reading about it. I'm always talking it. I'm talking with other people about it. So most of that will come, you know, extemporaneously, but the rest of it, you know, some certain facts and figures that I want to make sure are exact, or if I do misplace something, oh, there it is, okay, or, you know, hey, there's a lot of lulls throughout a game, too, especially over a long season. You know, oh, I remember there was a story about Joey Votto and not popping the ball up, for instance. I know I have that. Let me look at it. Oh, okay, he went 2 years without hitting a pop-up. Okay. So to speak, you know, okay, there that is. Okay. You know, so sometimes I have things like that. So, I put all that in that OneNote, a couple of notebooks I have in OneNote, and, I'm able to retrieve all that. So it sounds seamless. It sounds like I know where everything is, you know, I know everything off the top of my head, but the key is to be able to access the information quickly. And as long as I can do that, then it sounds like I know what I'm talking about.
I wanted to ask you about those slower paced games, those games that have maybe gotten out of hand, a 10-1 game, for instance. It doesn't really matter who's winning, I guess. I imagine that those would be a whole lot harder to call than, let's say, a fast paced, exciting game with maybe something on the line. Even though a fast paced game is, you know, your heart's racing maybe a little bit more and you're more worried about making sure that you cover everything. I really have to imagine filling all those spaces in those slow games is really something that an announcer would struggle to deal with.
No, it's very different. No, a high stakes game is easy. You've got the crowd into it. There is natural intrigue. You set up situations, you know, and possibilities, and so just it's easy because you're just bringing the game to the person. You don't have to think of anything else. You're just bringing the game, and that's paramount and fully enraptures the audience. When it is 10-1, whether you're up or down, that doesn't really matter as much as the fact that the game is pretty much at hand, and very little of what's being played heretofore is going to matter. So you have to find ways to keep the audience engaged. If your team is up by that much, you could start talking about, well, you know, they haven't had 12 runs in a game in a year, you know, 15 in 3 years, you know, or what, you know, so stick around, see, you know, and then other way around, you don't want to really talk about, you know, well, that pitcher hadn't given up 10 runs in a start ever. Well, you know, you don't want to belabor that much, but it might, you know, say, well, you know, they did have a comeback of 9 runs 17 years ago, you know, or, you know, and in that game, Robin Yount hit 2 home runs. Speaking of Robin Yount, you know, he's, you know, did something like that and talk, you know, talk about something about Robin Yount, you know, for a little bit, you know. So, you know, that's the challenge, and that's where we make our money, you know, because, look, we've got to entertain for 162 games, and I don't think there's any better entertainer, and I don't think there's a lot of better broadcasters that can bring you those tight games too, like Bob Uecker. He is good in both avenues, and he has had, unfortunately, plenty of those 10-1 games to deal with, so he has become unquestionably the master at entertaining in those sorts of situations, so I've learned a lot from him.
Baseball, obviously, has been and always will be a very visual game, something that people, in order to get a real experience for it, way back in the day, people would have to go actually see it in person. And then radio came along, which helped people along. But now there's television and obviously video feeds on the internet and things like that. Do you as a radio announcer ever struggle with the fact that you know that your audience can't see what you're seeing and that you are not only their ears, but also their eyes? I imagine that it's not so much as of a hindrance as it is maybe a different way you have to approach the announcing of the game. I don't know, maybe I should rephrase this because I don't know if I'm asking it properly.
No, I totally understand what you mean, and I'm going to answer your question because I know what you're getting at. And You know, for me, I think I have to constantly remind myself of that. I don't think I have too much of a problem with it because I don't swing between TV and radio for baseball all that often. So I don't assume that the audience is seeing anything. The way that I started in pro baseball was in 2000 with the Charleston River Dogs. At that time, they were a Tampa Bay Devil Rays affiliate. And I was the broadcast intern. So I got to do a handful of games of play-by-play, but otherwise I was in studio the rest of the time. And so the normal announcers that season were guys named Jim Lucas and Don Wardlow. Well, Don Wardlow was the analyst. Don was born without eyes. And so when I would work games, I would work games with Don. And so I was literally working games next to a blind person. And what better reminder could a young play-by-play announcer need than the guy next to you can't see, just like the rest of the audience can't see, because it's radio. So if I didn't move up Josh Hamilton or Carl Crawford to the right base, if I didn't describe a play acutely enough, he would immediately let me know because he needed to know this information in order to respond. So I think I always carry a little Don with me. There's no bobblehead or anything like that. Otherwise, I'd probably carry that. But, you know, just being able to picture Don sitting next to me and thinking, well, if I hadn't described this very well, he would not know what's going on. And there is, you know, I mean, thank goodness for radio and thank goodness for baseball really keeping an emphasis on radio, unlike the other major sports. You know, many of them have kind of shied away from radio a little bit, but you know, there is a number of our audience every night that can't see, whether they come to the game or not, and they need to know this information. So I try to describe a player, whether it's you know, Andrew McCutchen, who everybody knows Andrew McCutchen. Well, not everybody knows Andrew McCutchen, so I'm going to tell you, you know, this slimly built you know, right-handed hitter with good power and you know, quick hands and quick swing, and you know, he's got his long hair flowing from the back of his black helmet with the you know, goldenrod P on the front, you know, or whatever. So I try to mix in some of that because, you know, you think of Andrew McCutchen maybe as a very you know, this guy from another team. Well, he's the MVP. Well, is he a big slugger? No, he's not. He's a small guy, you know, but he's got a lot of punch. And so, you know, I don't try to assume anybody knows anything when I talk about the game.
Well, for my money, radio is still the best way to catch a baseball game if you can't go see it in person. And certainly guys like you make listening to the game a whole lot more enjoyable. And Joe, I want to thank you for joining me on Stealing Home.
Well, I hope I didn't use up too much time on the internet today. David, thanks for having me on.
Joe Block is a radio announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers. You can catch his work on 620 AM WTMJ when you're in the greater Milwaukee area. You can follow him on Twitter at @Joe_Block. To end every show, I like to highlight someone who, for reasons on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. The original presenters, the very first people who allowed fans from all over the country to keep up with the goings-on of their favorite team, were the sports writers. Baseball writers have been around nearly as long as the professional game, and for all but the very few who had the opportunity to see a game in person, the beat writers were the portal to the game. They held the keys. And so in 1936, when the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum was founded, the hall decided that the ones who should vote, the people who would decide who would be enshrined in Cooperstown, were really the only people that got to see all the players and games in person. On a fundamental level, this makes perfect sense. And for most of the last 75 years, the whole process has been pretty successful. The no-doubters got voted in, and though there are certainly some possibly suspect omissions and inclusions, the hall is full of players who deserve to be there. There may be some mistakes, but that's unavoidable when the human element is involved. But quite recently, the whole process has seemingly taken a turn for the worse. Part of it comes from the rise in use and popularity of statistical analysis. As more information becomes easily available, people are starting to see that perhaps some players, because of their numbers, deserve a second look. The bigger effect comes, of course, from the so-called steroid era. Much derision and infighting has resulted as writers decide how players implicated should be handled. Writers have used their platform as a voter for editorializing and posturing. Blanket assumptions have been cast seemingly unfairly. The Hall, as an organization, has so far done nothing to lay out guidelines or ground rules, leaving everything up to the writers. And all of this has created a toxic environment. It has deeply darkened the process that for so many years was a point of excitement for fans. Hall of Fame voting season has become something we have to live through, rather than something we look forward to. When a process is clearly broken, sometimes it takes a person on the inside to truly expose it. And that's what Dan Le Batard tried to do in 2014. Le Batard is the host of a national radio and television show and a writer for the Miami Herald, the latter being his credentials to vote for the Baseball Hall of Fame. Le Batard has been known as sort of a loose cannon at times, but he would not have the success he does if he didn't know his stuff when it came to sports. And when Le Batard decided he had had enough, when he couldn't vote for the Hall of Fame in good faith anymore, he made a career-altering decision. The website Deadspin.com was also looking to expose what they thought was wrong with Hall of Fame voting and put out feelers to writers looking to buy their votes. They wanted to have at least one vote decided on by the fans. They would poll their readers and fill out the ballot based on what the readership decided. Deadspin later announced that they had found their voter. It wasn't revealed until after the Hall of Fame announcements that Dan Le Batard was that writer. He requested that Deadspin make a donation to charity in lieu of his payment. Le Batard didn't have to expose that he was the one who let Deadspin vote on his behalf, but he wanted to put his name on it. And the baseball world proceeded to, and I'm putting this lightly, totally lose their shit. The topic was brought up on ESPN's show Pardon the Interruption, a show that Le Batard frequently filled in on. The hosts, Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon, know Le Batard and know him well. And when the news broke, they went on their show and said things like this.
Should the Baseball Writers of America immediately revoke Dan's vote? Please, say yes.
Yes, but sooner than immediately.
And this.
Don't throw your vote away.
It's so sanctimonious for Le Batard to offer up this garbage, okay?
And this.
Don't tell me that the process is flawed.
And this.
This is egotism run amok. I don't think you give your vote. First of all, it's vote fraud.
And this.
We are not immune to this. We are self-congratulatory people. But this is even beyond us.
But the whole I'm going to give it away.
Stop.
Don't do that.
And we love you.
Love you, Danny.
You're wrong.
These are his colleagues and friends, and they still lambasted him like this. Le Batard's ballot, which ended up voting for 10 players, all of whom had Hall of Fame cases, was cast the same year that one writer turned in a blank ballot, one voted for Jacques Jones, one voted for Hideo Nomo, and one voted only for Jack Morris, excluding even Tom Glavin and Greg Maddux. All of these voters were making some sort of statement. Le Batard, by allowing fans to decide who should get in, was the only one to get his vote stripped. He will never vote for the Baseball Hall of Fame again. Le Batard said, quote, "I'm not sure what kind of trouble this is going to bring me. I imagine I'll probably have my vote stripped, but I don't want to be a part of the present climate without reform anyway. Given that climate, doing this has more impact than my next 20 years of votes as sanctimony bars the Hall of Fame doors on the steroid guys. Because in a climate without reform, my next 20 years of votes will be counted but not actually heard. At least this gets heard, for better or for worse. End quote. Whether you agree with Lebatard's decision or not, you have to give him credit for his moxie. He saw something he didn't like, and he went out to change it. He didn't harm anyone or destroy anything or even call anybody any names. He made a silent protest of the loudest magnitude. In 10 years, when we talk about the Hall of Fame, no one will remember who turned in the blank ballot in 2014, but they will remember Dan Le Batard. He made a stand in the best way he knew how. Some people hated it, but if you make a gesture everyone likes, you're not taking much of a stand in the first place. A vote in the Baseball Hall of Fame is not sacred. If you do a good job, you do not get into a special baseball heaven. Neither do the players. It's a museum meant to recognize the great contributors to a game that has no real discernible impact on the world at large. This isn't to say a Hall of Fame vote is without meaning. It just doesn't carry as much weight as some people have come to believe. It's part of a process. Dan Le Batard didn't like that process, and he chose to let everyone know this. He stood his ground while facing certain punishment and ridicule. And for that, Dan Le Batard is the MVP of my heart. That's it for this episode. Stealing Home is hosted, produced, and scored by me, David Temple. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio and on Twitter at twitter.com/stealinghomeorg. Don't forget to go to stealinghome.org for show notes on this episode and every episode past. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and review us if you would be so kind. I'm David Temple. We'll see you next time on Stealing Home.